Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1995, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a union leader. He was born into a poor Scottish family, left school at 15 and joined the railways. He's been there ever since, starting out as a signalman in the remote west of Scotland, and then in 1983 as the candidate from nowhere, winning a landslide victory to become leader of the rail union. Most recently, of course, he was in the public eye as the man who led a long and bitter series of one-day strikes against Railtrack. Once accused of being a stooge of the communist left, he's risen to become the popular leader of a combined transport union. He's the General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, Jimmy Knapp. There have always been contradictions surrounding your image, Jimmy. You know, you're sometimes portrayed as being the crusty dinosaur, the traditional trade unionist, Jurassic Jimmy, I've seen you called. And then the next minute you're this rather popular leader who's dedicated to forming a voter-friendly Labour Party. Will the real Jimmy Knapp stand up? Which one are you?
Well, I think, hopefully, a person who has always tried to tell it as it is. You know, to say to the public and the nation, well, this is the truth, this is the story. And of course, there are those in the media, newspapers particularly, who will always try to slap the dinosaur label on any trade union leader. But I think they've had some difficulty with that in recent times, because I think that a lot of our messages got through.
But it becomes quite personal, doesn't it, inevitably, on the trade union leader. And they always mention two things about you. They mention your appearance and they mention your accent. I mean, politically incorrect questions, though they are. Let me ask you, first of all, about the accent. Do you think that that's been an impediment to your getting the message across as you've tried to convey what you really feel to rail passengers up and down the country?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've been proud of my Ayrshire accent. It is an Ayrshire accent. I've lived in the London area now for 23 years, but I've defended it very well.
And you've clung on to it.
And I've clung on to it. And, you know, I think the Geordies appreciate it because I appreciate their accent. I think the Brummagers appreciate it because I appreciate their accent. And I don't think that's been a problem at all. I think they know who you are and they take you as you are.
What about the appearance? And I can ask you that because it seems to me in many articles I've read about you, it's you who's always pointing out that you're much younger than you look. You're always quoted as saying, I'm the same age as Cliff Richard, which is now, what, 54?
Yeah, well, I think it was actually William Hickey in the Daily Express gossip column about 10 years ago that first compared me to Cliff Richard. I'll admit that I'm never going to win the Best Dressed Man contest. As far as the comparison with Cliff is concerned, whom I admire very much, the big advantage I've got over him is that I'll always look the same. But he's going to spend 20 years getting older.
Are you an emotional man? Can you be moved by music?
Yes, indeed. Yes, you can be moved by that. I mean, it does stir something in your breast. There's no doubt about that. And I don't think you'd be human if it didn't.
Right, let's find out which bits specifically stir you. What's the first record you'd take to your desert island?
Well, the first choice would be a Robert Burns song, The Bonnie Lass of Ballochmyle. Ballochmyle isn't far from the village where I was brought up, and I used to wander around that area. We used to go fishing in the summertime at 4 o'clock in the morning and watch the trains go by over the splendid viaducts in that area. So I think that song encapsulates those kind of happy moments.
There is the morning flowery May, and sweetest night in autumn mild, when roving through the garden gay, or wandering in a lonely wild, but woman, nature's a charm she does compile. Even there her ever work works are foiled. Even there her heather works are foiled. By the bonny lass o' Ballochmyle. The bonny lass o' Ballochmyle.
Kenneth McKellar singing Robbie Burns' Bonny Lass of Ballochmyle. You're an old-fashioned railwayman, though, Jimmy, in the sense that it's a passion. It's been a passion since you were very small. How small?
Oh, I would think going back to about 10 or 11 years old, when we used to go and watch the steam trains in Hulford, which was the village where I was brought up, to see the big steam locomotives thundering by, all in the express trains from Glasgow to London. You know, it was a great experience, and I really got interested in it.
And did you spend all your spare time at it? I mean, was it more interesting to you than to many of your friends?
Well, there was more than myself, of course. I mean, there were others who indulged in that kind of activity, but I don't think that any of the others really... They couldn't have got the steam into their blood as much as I got it,
did you know,
because they all went their separate ways.
Did you get into a signal box?
Well, yes, because the watching the trains and taking the numbers led me to sit on a bank one day behind a signal box and watching what was going on, and managed to persuade the signalman to let me into the signal box, you know, and became quite fascinated by all that was going on there. You know, the bells ringing, the clash of the old steel levers and all the rest of it. And I think I must have been about 14 then.
So was this all to the detriment of your schoolwork then?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I could have had an academic schooling, I believe, but I don't think the interest was really there.
Have you then left when you were 15 because of the love for railways and went to work on them. Have you any regrets about that now?
No, none at all. You know, I've enjoyed every minute of my working life in the railways. I've enjoyed every minute of trade union activity, so I've got no regrets whatsoever. And
but you said just now you could have had an academic career, because I know that your critics have made a lot of the fact that you failed some written exam in order to get a place in the union about 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, there's a story attached to that exam, you know, which I won't go into now. I don't think it was quite like the exams that you sit at school. But, no.
So your enemies fixed it, did they?
Well, I mean...
they made sure you didn't pass.
I'll leave other commentators to speculate on that. But I think going back to the school days, the interest just went. I mean, you have to apply yourself to whatever you're doing. And I just didn't have the desire to... You know, to have that kind of application to the schoolwork, because it moved away to a desire to work on the railways.
And that was 1955, and you got to be a signal boy, and you earned £10 a week. Let's pause there for record number two. Tell me about that one.
Well, I'd like to hear the Beatles record Yesterday, because that came at a point in my life when I was a bit low. My mother had just died in 1962. You know, there's a lot of sentiment in that record, Yesterday, because I was trying to put some of the bad days behind me.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me.
The Beatles and Yesterday, and memories of your mother, Jimmy Knapp, who died when you were 21. And that rather knocked you for six, didn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I love my mother dearly. And, you know, to see her go at the age of 46 was a real tragedy. And something I've never forgotten even now.
What sort of circumstances had you lived in up till then as a boy? You lived in a village on the outskirts of Kilmarnock, you say.
Yes.
What was it like?
Well, I was brought up in a house where we didn't have running water or electricity or a toilet. You know, if you had to get up in the middle of the night, you had to put your coat on. The village itself was full of heavy industry, brickworks, iron foundries and, you know, coal mines and the railways.
But why were you attracted then to the railway community? What was special about that then?
It's hard to say that. I mean, I think it's just because it grew in me, you know, from the age, as we were talking about earlier, watching the trains and being in the signal box. It just grew. It wasn't a case of saying, well, there's no way I'm going down a coal mine, or there's no way I'm going to spend 8 hours in a blast furnace. I mean, it just kind of grew that way.
But what are your early memories of working on the railway?
It was a very different world. If you showed some of the scenes now that used to take place, I mean, people would think you'd made a movie out of it. But, I mean, if you were working on a country station, for example, the local hotel might have ordered salmon for dinner. And, you know, we used to carry the salmon down the street to the hotel and deliver it. And we used to get a glass of whiskey when we'd finish for our trouble. In those days, they had what they called the signal box lads, and their job was to answer the telephones, take messages and record the passage of trains. But of course, there was always the temptation to have a go at working the signal box, which we did quite often. I mean, I suppose it was like the pilot of a jet letting the first officer fly you to Glasgow, you know. And that was a great time, but as I say, they were great people.
You know. And did you get paid walking time to walk to your signal box?
Yes, we did. I mean, that was one of Bob Horton's. I don't think he understood it during the railway strike of 1994, you know, because the walking time was actually paid for the inconvenience to relief signalmen who had to cover sometimes 20 to 25 signal boxes.
But they didn't have to walk to them like you did in those early days?
No, I mean, I walked most of the time because we couldn't afford to do it any other way.
That's our record number three.
Yes, well, that's part of the romanza, or the romance, from the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto number 20, played by the famous German pianist Walter Gieseking. The thing about that record is that it's got a touch of magic about it. I mean, it is romance. And having heard it in Salzburg, which is where Mozart's father was the director of music to the Archbishop, and having heard it played in the room where Mozart actually performed in the Schloss Mirabell in Salzburg, I mean, it left an indelible impression on me.
Part of the second movement, the romance of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 in D minor, played by Walter Gieseking with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Hans Rosbaud. So it was during that time on the Scottish railways in the second half of the 50s and then through the 60s that you, Jimmy Knapp, imbibed, if you like, your socialist principles. Was there anyone in particular who influenced you, or was it simply in the air that you breathed?
There was no one person in particular. I think you put your finger on it. I mean, it was in the air. I mean, it was an area where there was a lot of heavy industry. The trade unions were well organised. And, you know, I think I'd been about 2 days working in the signal box when the signalman said, you better sign this form, son, because you better join the union. I think that was in about day three. And, of course, you know, rubbing shoulders with some of them, you know, who were active in the union branch locally. And, you know, having read the book The Socialist Six of the World at that time, which was written by Hewlett Johnson, who was known as the Red Dean of Canterbury, that brought home to me the injustice of some of the things that had gone on, you know, during the earlier part of the 20th century, when during the 20s and 30s, you know, children in big cities like Glasgow and Liverpool were suffering from rickets, which is caused directly by malnutrition, when at the same time surplus oranges were being dumped out in the Mersey. You know, there didn't seem to me to be much justice in that. And, You know, I think I began to grow that sense of needing to fight for justice and fight for fairness and fight for equality.
So you became active in the union very early on, as you say. You were a dues collector at the age of 18. You were branch secretary at the age of 21. Did you know then early on that you wanted, had you got your eye fixed on a top job, that you wanted to make the union a career?
No, certainly not. I mean, I never ever had dates ringed in the calendar, you know, that was going to be, that somebody was going to pass away on a certain date or retire on a certain date, and I was going to fill their shoes.
You're not an ambitious man?
No. No, not in the true sense of the word, no.
Record number 4.
I've always derived a great deal of pleasure from the works of Robert Burns, because he was a superb social commentator. A lot of what he wrote is still very appropriate to some of today's problems, and I'd like to hear a reading from Man Was Made to Mourn, which really encapsulates one of the big problems of today, you know, the problem of unemployment, or indeed the homeless in our society. I think A Man Was Made to Mourn encapsulates the problem very well, even though it was written over 200 years ago.
See yonder poor or laboured wight, so abject, mean and vile, who begs a brother of the earth to give him leave to toil. And see his lordly fellow worm, the poor petition spurn, unmindful though a weeping wife and helpless offspring mourn. If I'm designed yon lordling slave, by nature's law designed, why was an independent wish e'er planted in my mind? If not, why am I subject to his cruelty or scorn? Or why has man the will and power to make his fellow mourn?
That was Alexander Morton reading that, part of Robert Burns' Man Was Made to Mourn. So you went south eventually. You left Scotland, Jimmy. You went down to work on London Underground when you were 31. And
yes.
Then you went to Leatherhead in Surrey, the Southern Region Divisional Officer, and then to NUR headquarters in 1981. And 2 years later, you were top dog. You succeeded Sid Weill as General Secretary. It was he who called you, and I mentioned it in the introduction, a stooge of the communist left, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did that hurt?
No. I mean, it was predictable because I wasn't his favoured candidate, so, I mean, obviously he wasn't going to say very nice things about somebody that he was opposing.
But people have gone on saying that you're a prisoner of your left wing, haven't they? That you're a willing tool of the hard left on your executive.
No, I don't think they would accept that. I don't think the hard left would accept that, because I've always been my own man, and I've always argued what I felt was best for the union. If that ran me into a row where hard left, centre or right, then so be it. Because I think if you are the General Secretary of a major union, that's the way you've got to think. You know, you've got to argue what you believe is right and what is best.
But you don't have total executive power, do you? You can negotiate, but you can't deliver. You've got to persuade. I mean, how many others on your executive committee? 20?
Well, this year there's 19.
Yeah.
So I don't have a vote. So there is an element of persuasion, yes, and trying to win support for your own point of view.
But isn't that difficult if you've gone in and negotiated something and then you come out, you sit down with them and they say no, you can't, so you can't deliver?
Well, that's the democratic process at work, you know, and you have to try to win the argument and convince people that it's best.
The offer that you finally accepted after last year's strike, last summer's strike, was more or less the offer that was on the table 2 months earlier. Had you wanted to accept it then?
No, I mean, it was actually an improved offer. There was more money in it.
But in hindsight, did you not hold out too long for too little?
No, I don't think so. Well, I know we didn't, because, I mean, serious negotiations didn't really get underway until within 10 days of the end of the dispute. I mean, we had a long period where the government's hand was on the tiller or on the scruff of Bob Horton's neck, whatever way you like to describe it, where no serious negotiations took place. You know, there was a standoff.
So to answer another criticism, would you deny that you were a stubborn man?
I'm stubborn if I'm fighting for justice, you know, but not stupidly stubborn.
Because I notice you chose last year, towards the end of last year, when you were asked to read a Shakespearean speech on the television, you chose a piece from Julius Caesar, in which Caesar says, "I am constant as the northern star." I wondered if you... that had a special meaning for you.
You can't compare yourself to Julius Caesar, really, but...
Well, look what happened to him.
Well, that's right. But I think the message was that we knew where we were going and we held our course until we got there.
Some more music.
Yes, well, of course, we were talking about the 80s, and, you know, the most momentous event of the 80s was without doubt the miners' strike of 1984-5. I've never seen such courage and sacrifice among ordinary people as I did during that period. And having been part of it, you know, which will be looked on as one of the big events in industrial relations history, I think I would like to hear the miners' hymn, Gresford.
Gresford, the miners' hymn, played by the Grimethorpe Colliery Band, and a tribute from Jimmy Knapp to the miners and their families involved in that strike of 84-85. But you've also been critical, Jimmy, about the way it was conducted. You've said before now that it was arrogant and undemocratic.
Well, I can't remember ever saying that, but I think, looking back, it was a hard fight for the miners. I mean, they... I think knew that their industry was at the crossroads, and you know, I wouldn't really want to be critical in that sense.
But you were then presumably being critical of Arthur Scargill, who called them out on strike without
well, no,
there being
a ballot. Not particularly. I mean, I think with hindsight, the ballot always gives you that kind of strength, and we've always gone to the ballot.
You'd never call a strike without a ballot.
Well, certainly not. I mean, but. You know, I've got nothing but admiration for the miners and their families involved in that dispute.
The miners' strike was, of course, the last great union versus government battle, and they lost. Trade union laws were put in place, and the TUC has steadily lost its clout since then. Do you see trade unions ever achieving the power they enjoyed in the 70s again?
Well, I don't accept that, you know, if you talk about the trade union movement as a whole, that it has lost its clout. I mean... we are still exerting a lot of influence, and we are still being effective.
But it's a different kind of influence now, isn't it? And I mean, to characterise it with the old cliche, beer and sandwiches at number 10, I mean, those days are gone. Do you think they will ever return? The days, actually, when trade unions could bring down governments.
I'm
that's
not
what
sure.
We're talking about.
I mean, well, I don't know about any trade unions that ever brought down governments. I mean,
what about the Heath government?
Well, yes, but he could have stayed there for another year. I mean, it was Ted Heath that chose to go to the country and say who governs Britain. It wasn't the
but
unions.
What about the winter of discontent?
Well,
I mean, in effect, that did for the Callaghan government.
Well, it may have done in the sense that, you know, there was a lot of discontent among a lot of ordinary people about, you know, what had happened to their living standards and all the rest of it. But... you know, the beer and sandwiches description is a good cliche. I mean, I don't think... I can remember Sidney Green, who was a general secretary of the NUR, telling me about a time when the union called a strike in 1960. And that was resolved in the end after he and Harold Macmillan had strolled round the gardens of Downing Street. I don't see that kind of world coming back, but... but there'll have to be an acceptance eventually that there are social partners in the world. You know, you've got employers, you've got people who go to work, trade unions, and you've got government. That's a common approach in many of our European partners in their countries, and I think it will come in this country eventually. It's got to come if we're going to make a success of, you know, economic growth and all the other things that we want to achieve.
More music.
I suppose the country that I like best after Scotland is Spain. Not the Spain of Torremolinos or Benidorm, although millions of people enjoy themselves there, and quite right too, you know, but the Spain of Seville and Cordoba and Barcelona, you know, but most of all Granada. So just thinking about Spain and the enjoyable hours there, I would like to hear Granada sung by Plácido Domingo.
Se vuelve gitano cuando es para ti mi cantar hecho de fantasía mi cantar flor de melancolía que yo
Granada, sung by Plácido Domingo with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Karl-Heinz Lorges. What about the railways then, Jimmy Knapp? You're fundamentally opposed to privatisation, but the wheels grind inexorably on towards it. Why wouldn't it benefit the railways?
The main reason we're opposed to privatisation of the railways is that it won't deliver a better service. It'll deliver worsening and deteriorating services. Privatisation has been presented as the panacea for the industry's ills, but the patient's health is deteriorating. I mean, you just need to look at last week's announcement where we had minimum service standards set at levels below the current services, where we've seen a move towards reducing the amount of through ticketing in the system. We've seen the withdrawal of the sleeper services from London to Fort William and the southwest of England to Edinburgh. We've seen the withdrawal of the motor rail services. I mean, here we are in a very congested island with environmental concerns growing. And it's sheer lunacy to do away with the only bit of combined transport we've got.
Do you think, despite your best arguments, it will happen nevertheless?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think the government have got enormous problems about the privatisation of the train operating companies and rail track. There's very little interest in the private sector in relation to the train operating units. There's no businessman or woman going to be interested in a situation where they don't control 75% of their fixed overheads. I mean, it's not a good business position to be in, so there's not a lot of interest.
But a cynic would say, of course, that last summer's strike added to that, and that maybe that was part of the object of it, to frighten off potential buyers, that you set out on you set out to sabotage it.
No, I can assure yourself and the world that's listening that last year's strikes were a 100% industrial argument. If the spin-off from that is harm privatisation, then that's a case of the government shooting themselves in the feet, because they could have avoided it had they not interfered in the way that they did.
If it were privatised, would you look to an incoming Labour government to renationalise it immediately?
Yes, to bring it back into public ownership, because we believe that that's the only form of ownership that's going to deliver to the public the standard of service that they need.
And are you convinced that an incoming Labour government would do that?
I'm convinced that there's a firm commitment to a publicly owned railway. I believe that what we have to set about doing is working out the pros and cons of that.
But if they do away with Clause 4, there's not a firm commitment to common ownership, is
there? Well,
it?
I don't think Clause 4 will be done away with. You know, it may be rewritten or amended in some form in the weeks that lie ahead of us, but there should be a commitment to public ownership, and I think there will be a commitment to public ownership, because I think it's recognised that the post office, the railways, to pick but two examples. That's the right place for them to be.
Record number 7.
Well, coming to London as I did in 1972, I began to appreciate the city, and eventually came to appreciate the theatre. And I think the most enjoyable moment in that period was going along to Sadler's Wells one evening and seeing and listening to Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. And I'd like to hear a piece from Fantasy Overture.
Part of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, played by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. I assume, Jimmy Knapp, that you'll cope on this desert island. I mean, you're no stranger to physical hardship. I mean, you may not have suffered it for some years, but you're good with your hands, as they say.
Yeah, well, I'm no stranger to physical hardship, but I've always enjoyed people around me, so I think that would be my biggest problem.
But what would you do with yourself all day?
Well, I think I would probably set about making myself as comfortable as possible so that I could enjoy all the music and the other delights that I would have with me. Having spent 40 years now, almost, working on the railways and for the union, it might be nice to move to some relaxation at last.
Absolutely, and to put all that union politicking behind you, would there be a certain relief in that?
In a way, I suppose, yes, because you need. It would be, in some ways, it's not so much the politics, it's the responsibility, you know, that you feel that you in looking after people and doing the best for them, and you have to put your best foot forward at that.
But do you enjoy that part of it? I mean, obviously, when there's a strike on, and it lasted, what, from June to September last year, your workload must have increased enormously, and you were constantly in demand on the radio and the television and the newspapers. I mean, obviously, nobody enjoys strikes, and you don't want your members to be out, but, you know, is there a secret part of you that does actually rather like those periods?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think you step up a gear, you know, and you set yourself out to project the case to the maximum effect. Well, it's an opportunity to say what you think. So I think you do enjoy it in a way, yes.
Last record.
Well, I'm going back to Scotland again, to Argyllshire, where I spent a lot of happy hours. Beautiful part of Scotland, which is a feeling I think is shared by Paul McCartney. I've never met him, but I'm sure, well, I know that his feelings for that part of Scotland are as strong as mine. And I think that's why he wrote the Mull of Kintyre, as a tribute to that part of Scotland and to the people of that part of Scotland. And I'd like to hear that because I share his view.
Mull of Kintyre by Paul McCartney and Wings and the Campbelltown Pipe Band, you say, Jimmy?
Yes, indeed.
got them all involved?
Well, I think that was his tribute to the community, and it's my tribute to Argyllshire and my fellow Scots.
Now, if you could only take one of those records, which would it be?
Well, that's a difficult choice. I think probably Yesterday, because that reminds me most of my mother and the time that she died in that period of my life. And I think that I would treasure that thought, and so that record I would take, I think.
And what about a book?
Well, certainly The Socialist Six of the World, because you would never tire of reading it, by Hewlett Johnson. I mean, people think the Bishop of Durham was some kind of unique figure, but I think there's always been church men and women that have argued for justice, and Hewlett Johnson was one of those.
What about a luxury?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. A crate of Talisker whiskey, for two reasons. It's a wonderful malt that's a bit stronger than some of the others, and it comes from the beautiful island of Skye.
So a glass of malt whiskey and a bit of Tchaikovsky and a bit of Mozart and a bit of Beatles and Kenneth McKellar, and you're a happy man, are you?
Absolutely.
Jimmy Knapp, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.